Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, December 3rd. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy Today, and joining us on the line, author, editor, astronomer Bob Berman, and Dr. Valerie Rapson, Assistant Professor of Physics and Astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. They are here to answer your questions about space, the final frontier. Give us a call, 800-348-2551. If you have an astronomy question, 800-348-2551 is the number. You can also email us, voxpop@wamc.org. That's voxpop@wamc.org. Bob Berman, Valerie Rapson, your astronomy calls coming up on Vox Pop after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Two astronomers with us today to answer your questions about space and everything in it. One of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the whole world, Bob Berman, is the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. Dr. Valerie Rapson earned her Ph.D. in astrophysical sciences and technology from RIT. Her research focused on the structure and composition of planet-forming disks around nearby young stars. Dr. Rapson spent 5 years developing and teaching astronomy education programs for the Dudley Observatory and is now an assistant professor in the Physics and Astronomy Department at SUNY Oneonta. You got a question about astronomy? We have people who can answer them. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 is the number, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Bob Berman, before we get started here, how are the book sales? Are you a millionaire yet, sir?
Funny. Great to be here, Ray. Thank you. Thank you. But, you know, pure science, I'm not going to get rich from pure science, but, you know, can't complain either.
You got a new book. What's the name of the book again?
The new book, and this is the first time that I'm the third author listed, so I hesitate to even say it, but it's A Grand Biocentric Design, How Life Creates Reality. This is, again, biocentrism, showing how the nature and consciousness, that is, individual awareness, are actually intimately linked, except this one more proves the case through a lot of physics.
Well, you're the third author, but we know that you did all the work. I mean, who are we kidding here, right?
I did write most of it, yeah.
Dr. Valerie Rapson, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing good, doing good. And I haven't received my free copy of your book yet, Bob.
Okay, we'll do that. You know, when are we going to get back to the studio? You know, we're getting it all, we'll get vaccinated in a few months.
Well, once you're vaccinated, let me know. We'll hose the studio down and we'll bring you both back in. Hey, now, we have a list of things to talk about. And one of the great things about WAMC listeners is they are so up on things that most of our topics are already on the board of calls here or in the email. So I thought we would jump to the email here and read one from Alice in Syracuse. And this is something that we were talking about this morning, and Valerie has some firsthand experience, so we'll throw it over to her after I read this. This is from Alice. Sure. Alice says, yesterday's meteor here in Syracuse, we all heard the boom. A little after noontime, I thought it was snow sliding off the roof, but quickly realized that the half inch of lake effect we had couldn't have caused that. The big tree was still intact, and this morning we heard about the meteor just in time for the astronomy show. Can you fill us in on what you know? How big do you think it was? Did it land somewhere? Was it completely burned up on entry? Is it on the bottom of Lake Ontario? Of course, no one around here saw anything because it's always cloudy. And that's from Alice in Syracuse. Now, Valerie, you heard this as well, right?
Yeah, I did. And I was just like the writer. I didn't realize it was an astronomical event until a friend texted me last night and was like, did you hear about the meteor over Syracuse? And I started to look into it and realized that around noontime, I was sitting in my office and I heard this bang, but I live down the street from a logging company. So I thought it was just one of the trucks coming by, you know, the logs bouncing around. But then I realized after reading the articles that I think I heard the sound from this meteor that came over central New York. I didn't see it, of course, but I definitely heard it.
There was a video, I think, from Ontario with quite a bright flash. This happened around noontime, I understand, and it was seen, I guess there were reports from Maryland, to Michigan, to New York, to Ontario, Pennsylvania, Virginia. It was fairly high up there. Bob, how big do you think this thing was?
You know, that's hard to say. When you get a bright flash like that, of course, then it's officially called at least a fireball, if not a bolide. You know, the name, there's so many different names. We could talk about that later if you want. But generally, if something's the size of a walnut, it's going to be bright enough to cast shadows. So you don't have to be that big to really be dramatic.
You know, I'm trying to think of the agency that's explain this. The American Meteor Society said, you know, this is most likely a disintegrating meteor. But it occurs to me that, I mean, how can you really prove that? There's so much space junk up there and rocket boosters and everything else. How do we really know it was a meteor?
You're right. I mean, the best way is if you actually had video of the entry, and then you can plot it backwards and see what the trajectory is, and you can eliminate things coming, falling down from the sky, because everything that we have in orbit orbits in only one of two directions. So, but objects that are coming in from space can come from any direction. So that you can eliminate artificial things like burnt up satellites, tumbling satellites, and things like that, just from the incoming path.
Is there any chance at all that Alice's question about it being at the bottom of Lake Ontario could be true, Valerie?
Yeah, it probably is true. You know, there's so much more water on this planet than there is land, so it's likely that it just kind of fell into Lake Ontario or somewhere nearby. And because we actually, you know, saw the flash and heard the boom, you know, most of it probably disintegrated in the atmosphere, so I wouldn't expect to find a huge chunk of it at the bottom of Lake Ontario, but maybe small bits have sunk there for sure.
Bob, the boom we heard was a sonic boom, or was this the explosion of the actual bolide?
No, probably a sonic boom. I mean, you think back to Chelyabinsk a few years ago on February 15th of 2013, was it, over Siberia, and there the explosion 18 miles up equaled that of an atomic bomb, enough to break windows. So, and yet there, yeah, it broke up, but there were pieces that were recovered, including pieces that went through ice of small ponds and were fished out. So, yeah it's possible.
All right, now, I tell you what, the second topic I had is covered by Cooper in Middletown. So let's take a call here before the first break. Cooper in Middletown, you go ahead.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I read online that the Arecibo satellite dish or observatory in Puerto Rico recently collapsed, and I just wanted to ask what that means for the field of astronomy going forward, or if it was.
Yeah, it's a heartbreak. Maybe, it's a heartbreak.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And if it was just through neglect or something.
It was lack of funding, certainly. It didn't receive the funding for the upkeep it should have had. Yeah.
Yeah.
Valerie.
Exactly. And there's quite a few other radio observatories that you know, are scattered across the world that astronomers will be using. This wasn't the only one that we had, but it's such a historic telescope, right? It's been around since the 60s. For a long time, it was the largest radio dish in the world. I mean, it was in contact, right? We all love this telescope. So it was not only a good scientific instrument, but I think, you know, we personally connected with it. So it's such a shame that it's falling apart, but
they used a unique process for it. Instead of the steerable kind of dish that most of us visualize when we think of radio telescopes, this took advantage of a valley that happened to have a contour, a terrain that was almost perfect from the beginning. That if you just almost cover the terrain, I'm simplifying a little bit, you'd have a parabolic dish. Of course, it's not steerable. It always points to one spot. So instead of that, what you have is the platform that's elevated on cables above it, and the platform moves to go to different places where the rays, in these cases radio waves, can come to a focus. In truth, things are hitting this from all over the universe and coming to different foci or focuses in the air in different spots above it. So when you're interested in a particular object, you move the steerable steerable because there were three main cables that went from three towers, so that you're in the exact right spot so that you reach the focus of whatever the object is that you're interested in. Mm-hmm. Isn't that an interesting way of doing things?
It really is. And Cooper, thank you for the call. This was built in the 60s, and I think it was built with military money. They were tracking early satellites. And this was about 1,000 feet wide, right, Valerie? This was massive.
Yeah.
And the thing that really struck me in reading about this, and basically Bob alluded to these steel cables that held the receiver up, and that's what happened. They ended up breaking, and this 900-ton receiver fell into the dish, and so that's it for the dish. But just quickly before break here, Val, can you just tell us some of the science that was done with this thing over the years?
Oh, definitely. I mean, this was cutting-edge radio astronomy many years ago. We detected binary pulsars. I think there was a Nobel Prize that came from that. And we even tried to communicate with the aliens, right? You can look up the Arecibo message, and we can talk about the pictorial picture that went up there into space. And this telescope was special because it could not only receive signal, but it could also send the same types of signal into space. So a lot of great work was done with this, from looking at stars to galaxies to explosions. And now we're just going to have to look towards these other awesome radio observatories to continue the science.
Let's take a quick break. We are joined today by Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. It's Astronomy Today on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is our number. And we'll be back with more of your calls in a moment. And Joe Makowitz, our call screener, brings up a great point about the Arecibo telescope. It's also a shame for Bond fans. There's a great scene in GoldenEye where James Bond crawls over the top and fights the bad guy. Hey, before we get to our next call here on the Astronomy Show, and if you want to call, 800-348-2551 is the number. This is something that another caller had on the list here, and then I think that caller had to go. But I will ask it anyway because it was on our list of things to discuss. And that is something Bob and I have been talking about for months, and Valerie as well, and that is the so-called Christmas star, Jupiter and Saturn getting closer and closer this month. Bob, I'll let you take this.
Yeah, this is very exciting because, as I see it, it should be the best conjunction of our lives. And when we talk about a planetary conjunction, very few of us have seen a really great one. And this should surpass, in terms of spectacle, it should be better than many of the normal celestial headliners, like a Mercury transit, a lunar eclipse. There's a lot of events that get headlines. This will be more striking, and particularly so, you know, we're not into astrology. We astronomers never are. We disbelieve in it. But the astrological world will certainly be going nuts because of all the possible conjunctions of planets with other planets. Of the five planets, the most, I guess, significant through the ages, and this goes back centuries and centuries, thousands of years, and the rarest is when Jupiter meets Saturn. It happens every 20 years, and if you look it up online, you'll see all sorts of supposed earthly events, none of them good. They're all like scary type stuff. Right. You'll see things like that the presidents, whoever was a president or elected president during a time of a Saturn-Jupiter conjunction, had a high mortality.
Oh,
like
tremendous.
Kennedy, for
really?
Example.
Are you kidding me?
Yes. And if you look back, you can really see, there's some truth to that. So this was the only one called a great conjunction, capital G, capital C, great conjunction. They happen every 20 years. It last happened in 2000, and before that in October of 1980. It'll next happen, yes, right on schedule in 2040, 2060. But when they do happen, they're not usually as striking as this one, because the planets will be closer together than they were in either of those last two or any of the next two. They're going to be so close together that the two planets will almost merge into a single bright star. Not quite. That actually will happen in March of 2080 for that one. but it'll still be so striking that anyone can see it. And also, when they happen, they often happen in the glare of sunlight. Valerie knows about this kind of thing when an event is just too close to the sun and you can't see it well, or it's too low, too close to the horizon. Well, not this time. And it'll be on December 21st. So I don't think we're having another show between now and then. So everybody should really mark it on the calendar. That's the solstice. And that kind of raises this whole thing up astrologically to kind of DEFCON 3.
Wow.
This is like on December 21st, the day of the solstice, you should face where the sun set. In fact, it'll be the leftmost sunset of the year. The sun will set on the leftmost spot on your horizon. And half an hour after sunset, which around here in our listening area means around 5 o'clock, you should look. And by then, even though twilight will still be bright, it'll be fading, and there will be the two planets almost merging into one. Be really spectacular. Now, if you have a telescope or know a friend who has one or can contact your local astronomy club, you should do that, because through a telescope, wow, you're going to have those two largest planets in our solar system in the same field of view, in the same field of view, because Saturn will be as close to Jupiter as some of its moons are. It won't be actually mingling with the moons, because it'll be off in a different direction, but it'll be as close as the moon Callisto often gets. So imagine that, Saturn with the rings, Jupiter with its bands and stripes and all, and the moons in the same telescope field. So if you do have a telescope, that's the time to use it. So we're talking about 5 o'clock, December 21st. In the direction of sunset, look low, not super low, about 15 degrees high, so it's not, but still, if you've got any hills or trees or neighbors' houses there, check it out a few days ahead of time. And I know I'm hogging the microphone here, so I'll just finish up by saying a few days ahead of time, check it out at that same time, 5 o'clock, to make sure the planets are in the clear, because it'll be in the same place that day as it'll be on the 21st. And if they're not, if they're blocked, find a place. A field, a lakeside, a cemetery, a mall, parking lot, anything. We have a clear sky toward the direction of sunset, unblocked sky, unobstructed sky, so you know where to be. And then on the 21st, hopefully we'll have clear enough weather for it, because it's only a one-night thing. It's only going to be that one night that they're going to be that close together, and don't miss it.
Well, we've been watching them get closer and closer together over the last several months. It's been very
exciting.
But to be clear, you're a man of science, and you don't really put much stock in every 20 years something terrible happening because these things are coming together, right?
Right. I mean, we got through the one in 2000 and in 1980 and stuff.
All right.
So, yeah, sure.
Fair enough.
We're not worried.
All right, we'll get back to the phones here in just a moment. 800-348-2551. Valerie Rapson. It occurs to me this is happening around Christmas time, and these planets are coming close enough together that they would, in some instances, look like one big giant object. I am sure there is software, and somebody probably has done this. Can you go back in time and see maybe if this would be a candidate for that Star of Bethlehem all those years ago?
Oh, definitely. And people have been trying to trace this for a long time. I mean, you can even download the free software Stellarium and check it out yourself. You can set the dates and do everything and see where the planets were in the sky and if they got close enough. And I think one of the biggest problems with figuring out if the Star of Bethlehem was one of these planetary conjunctions is really nailing down the dates. Right? From the stories, we don't know exactly, what day and what year this happened, so it's hard to line it up with an astronomical event in the sky. But there are a couple of conjunctions and, potential supernova explosions in Andromeda that correlate with roughly the right time frame. So it is possible that the Star of Bethlehem was a real astronomical event, but we're not 100% sure.
Our number
the problem with that is, we got to say this, because my very first article in Discover magazine began my 17 years of being in every issue of Discover. This was in 1989 for the Christmas issue. I interviewed planetarium directors all around the country. And every planetarium, just about, runs something called Star of Wonder, or something with a similar name, about the Star of Bethlehem. The problem is, every planetarium director knows that it could not have been an actual object in the sky. They present the show says, could have been a comet, could have been a supernova, like Valerie said, could have been a conjunction, because there was one in 4 AD, and maybe Christ was born then, nobody's sure. But the problem is, anything in the sky, it can't lead. It means you can't follow something in the sky, because any natural object moves. It rises in the east, it crosses into the south, it sets in the west, so you go in a giant semicircle if you actually try to follow something in the sky. The only place in the sky where things are stationary are in the north, around Polaris, around the North Star, which actually was Coca back then, not Polaris, but never mind that. An object there doesn't seem to move, but that presents another problem, because the Magi were not going north, they were going southwest to get to Bethlehem. So nothing really works.
Okay.
You can't have an actual sky object, and yet they can't say that in the planetarium shows, because that's what's bringing in the people all want to hear what could have been, what could have been the science. Plus, and I'm going to finish up just by saying that most experts think it was probably astrological. In other words, great kings supposedly were accompanied, their births were announced by some astrological omen, which doesn't mean an actual spectacle in the sky. It's astrology. But as time went on, Christianity did not want to touch astrology. Science certainly doesn't want to bring up astrology as being a possible answer. So this, which is probably the truth behind the Star of Bethlehem business, which, by the way, was only in Matthew, it wasn't even in Luke. So there's a little question about why don't all the books of the Bible even say that it happened? But nobody wants to touch this thing astrologically.
Well, thanks for raining on everyone's parade, the entire world. Well done, Bob. Let's go to Thaddeus in New Braintree. Thaddeus, you're on.
Hi. Yeah, I was just thinking that maybe this was a grand conjunction with this phenomenon that I saw, but it was in the southeast. And I was looking, I live up on a cliff, I was looking out, I have a giant horizon view, and I'm seeing this like sparkle up in the sky, and I said, oh, it looks like an airplane coming. But then it wasn't moving, it just kept on staying there. So I put my glasses on, and it was still sparkling. Got my binoculars out, and I looked at it, and it had like kind of spiky looking thing, you know, like almost like the center spot was, you know, it was also changing color. It was like, it was mostly white, but there's blue and there's some green in it, a little bit of red in it. And it was like oscillating around, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't pulsating in a pattern or anything. It was just really flickering.
Okay, so and, it was like, it was lowish, and when was it? What season, what time?
I heard that you were going to be on today, so I went out and looked last night, and it was out there again last night. So it's around 10 o'clock at night. And it was up there in the I know, say 30 degrees up. And
what direction?
And then I got my telescope out. Yeah, southwest.
I can tell you what it was. Want me to tell you what it was?
Sure.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what it was. Because over the years, whenever I've gotten reports just like yours, especially of the color changing, that's proven to be the brightest star in the sky, Sirius, the dog star. Because it has an unusually intense spectrum. It's what we call spectral class A. Valerie knows all about this. And it has an unusual prismatic spectrum where the three primary colors of light, red, green, and blue, take turns in any kind of choppy air, which is what we usually have around here. So you see one color, then another, and the colors are intense, but they keep changing, especially when you see it through binoculars and stuff. And over the years, whenever I get a report like yours and the direction you were looking, that's where Sirius would have been, lowish but not super low. And especially lowish, you're looking through more air, and that even creates this chromatic aberration of the color changing.
Yeah, no, it was amazing. I even got the telescope out and looked at it that way, and I was like, no, it's not just my binoculars, it's not just my bad eyesight. It's pretty clearly changing color.
Okay, tonight, if it's clear tonight, here's how you can confirm it. Look up and to the right of this object and see if Orion's belt is pointing down and to the left toward it.
Okay.
And if it is, then it's serious.
So Ryan's belt will be pointing down at it to the left.
Yes.
Down to the left.
Correct.
Okay. Thaddeus, thanks a lot for the call. Valerie, did you want to chime in there?
Well, I just wanted to say that one of the key ways you can tell whether you're looking at a planet or a star, even if you don't have binoculars or a telescope, is to just notice the twinkling, like the caller said. Stars are going to twinkle, whereas planets, as long as they're, you know, a little bit above the horizon, generally won't twinkle because the stars are so much farther away that their light spreads out, and by the time it gets to the Earth's atmosphere, it really gets bounced around a bit. So the fact that the caller saw the spikes, as you described, and the colors bouncing around definitely tells you star instead of a planet.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. Marcia is in Altamont. Hello, Marcia.
Hello there. I was wondering, I'm a watcher of the night sky, and I was wondering if they could tell us what we might be looking for in terms of meteor showers over the next few weeks or a couple of months.
I'm so glad you mentioned it. The best meteor shower, I've been just waiting for an opportunity to say this, the best meteor shower of the year. And this year it's coming up with the moon not being bright, not interfering, are the Geminids. You know, the more famous shower of the Perseids every summer. But the Geminids for the last 10 or 20 years have been the better shower. And that's coming up on the night of December 13th to 14th. So it's coming up in just another, 10 days or so. And unlike the Perseids, you don't have to wait till after midnight for this one, because this one gets going early on. So as soon as it gets dark, pull up a lawn chair, and if you keep facing the sky and don't look away, you should be able to see one a minute.
Valerie.
Yeah, it's pretty spectacular. I mean, this is the perfect time to go outside. You can check out Jupiter and Saturn. You can check out the meteor shower coming up. Mars is also up in the sky. It's an amazing time to be outside. Even though it's a little chilly here in the Northeast, bundle up and go outside. You won't be disappointed.
Marcia, thank you for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today with Dr. Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. Let's go to Steve in Statsburg. Steve.
Yeah, hi. Comment and a question. The comment is just, I was in Puerto Rico this past early March and went to Arecibo, so I'm really glad I got to see it before all the destruction happened. Question is about meteors, and which would be the stronger effect on meteors, gravity or the Earth's magnetic field? And where I'm coming from is, I remember Bob saying that you know, the best place to look for meteors on the ground, or meteorites maybe, is in Antarctica, because, you know, there's the white snow and black meteors and so on. So I told my adult son that, just, you know, the best place to find meteors is Antarctica. And he said, oh, yeah, because of the magnetic field. You know, all the meteors would get pulled towards the South Pole or either pole. I don't know. I think it would be more gravity and momentum.
You're right. It is more gravity. The only meteors that are pulled on, I have a nice meteor collection myself, but the octahedrites, the nickel iron meteors, can be pulled by a magnet. But because of their high speed, typically 20 or 30 miles per second is their approach speed, they are not going to have their path deviated because of Earth's magnetic field. It's just not strong enough to do that. So it's not even Earth's gravity that's pulling them in. They have their own space velocity, and they're meeting Earth with our own space velocity. So it's sort of like a bullet meeting a bullet in space, and that's what produces the collision.
Right. And one of the reasons we find them more prominently at the North and the South Poles is because you've got so much snow there. So you've got this white-covered land, and then you've got these dark little rocks that are just spotted on top, and they're a lot easier to find there. It doesn't necessarily mean they hit there more frequently than anywhere else. They're just easier to find.
Exactly, yes.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call, and let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. Still time to get your call in. We'll open the email bag as well in a moment. Vox Pop on WAMC, Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman, and a program note coming up after this program. Our governor in New York State, Andrew Cuomo, will deliver an update on the COVID-19 pandemic. He's in Albany today. We'll air that for you live at 3 p.m.-ish, and that'll be right after we're done here. The number here is 800-348-2551. And some email here before we go to the calls once again. This one is from James. James says, what is known or not known about EMF as an infrared sauna? How does this compare to all other radiation? Valerie, you go first.
Well, I honestly don't know too much about, you know, EMF and exactly how it works. I know that we use, you know, EMF and sonar technology here on Earth and as well to probe the other planets a little bit on some of our spacecraft. But I don't know too much else about it. Maybe Bob can share a little bit more.
Well, I love making stuff up because that's what I do all the time here on the show.
We can just go with the flow here.
In my books. But I'm going to decline here just because I know so little about this that I would get really caught.
All right. Well, I know AMF used to make great bowling balls. That's one thing I'm... This is from Simon. Simon says, the way I understand dark matter and dark energy is to equate them to missing material or missing energy. How is consciousness accounted for, if at all, in the equations used to balance what we observe in the motions of galaxies? It seems to me that if an energy different than heat, light, etc., I think it should be considered.
Oh, interesting. I mean, I could talk about dark matter and dark energy, but Bob is really the connection with the consciousness. So, Bob, you go ahead and jump in.
Well, and with consciousness, that really needs a good setup. That's why one of the biocentrism books, I'd recommend the second one, by the way, Beyond Biocentrism, because I think it has a better introduction. And you have to look at this as it was developed, especially among the quantum people like Werner Heisenberg, who's really, really into this stuff. And the quick answer is that earlier this century, to everybody's surprise, it turned out that physics experiments wound up differently depending upon how they were observed. That if you were looking for waves, you would see waves. If you were looking for, did an experiment looking for particles, you'd see they weren't waves, they were particles. If you set up the famous double slit experiment, you'd actually get vastly different results depending upon when you looked and at which point you started observing. And so it became first like just a strange quirk, and then eventually everyone had to accept that somehow our presence as observers, our consciousness is important. And great astronomers like John Wheeler of Princeton started saying things like, no phenomenon is a real phenomenon unless it is an observed phenomenon. And many of us were going, whoa, really? I mean, we already gotten away from superstition and in many cases religion and gotten to a point where we trusted physics, where we didn't even trust the observer. The observer, we were less important than mice, laboratory mice. I mean, we wanted to take the observer out of the equation and consider the universe as sort of a machine that operates by itself, and who cares whether it's observed or not. And even Einstein hated the idea. It's called locality. Hated the idea of whether objects were really there if they weren't being measured. And now we don't believe it's so. Physicists no longer believe that small objects like electrons or waves of light have actual properties if they're not being observed. They kind of exist in a blurry state called a wave function. And until the wave function collapses, then the electron is born. Then it suddenly has a real position and a real motion. And so this is a pretty far out and pretty new. So before you can even bring consciousness into it, you have to see why we say that and realize that this is not just some kind of wacky, new age, Woodstocky kind of thing.
Although it certainly sounds that way. But that's okay.
It does.
This one is from Claire in Germantown. Astronomy gift ideas? Any gift ideas for an astronomy-loving spouse? And that's from Claire in Germantown. What about you, Valerie? You often go to the lower end of the price spectrum. And then we'll go to the higher
end
with Bob.
I do. Well, I mean, A pair of binoculars, a simple pair of binoculars, something you can get at any sports store would be a great start, or a lower-end telescope. Don't go to the department stores and buy a telescope. I highly recommend going online, reading the reviews, and getting something that, you know, people attest is a good, worthwhile telescope. And then any stargazing books, right? Or even a subscription to Astronomy Magazine is a great thing for somebody to get started with stargazing.
Did you say bless you, Bob? All right. You have any ideas?
You gotta read the magazine.
Yeah. And I am going to second what Valerie said. Binoculars are great. I don't think I'm allowed to give brand recommendations, right?
I wouldn't, unless you want to give more than one.
I'll give more than one. Low end for $25, $30, the Celestron binoculars are really good quality for cheap. And Valerie's absolutely right. You can do amazing things astronomically, plus use it in the daytime, too, for bird watching and things like that. And then high end these days for things like $1,500, there are the Canon image stabilized, especially the top model, the 10x40, which is the finest binocular you can use. So you can go high, you can go low end. But here's a quick suggestion. Here's something wacky for only $50. There's a company called United Nuclear, and they make something called a spintheroscope. Ray, did you have one as a kid? I did.
A what now?
A spintheroscope. It used a bit of radium. These days it uses a different radioactive material, and you can actually see the atom breaking apart on a screen.
Cool.
And producing like flashes of light as the atomic disintegration happens right before your eyes. And the spintheroscopes, they weren't available for 40 or 50 years, and now this company is making them again.
Wow.
So it's just a lot of fun in a dark room to look through this and watch atoms disintegrate. A company called United Nuclear is
okay. That's cool. I remember finding one of my great-grandfather's radium watches, and, I think the authorities came in and made me dispose of it. Let's go to Howard in New Paltz. Howard, you're on.
Yeah, hi, Mr. Berman. I understand you don't think much of astrology, but if you believe in consciousness, which means to me that everything on this planet and other planets and other moons and whatever they are all connected, why wouldn't you believe in astrology?
No, you're absolutely right. It sounds on paper, it sounds like it should work, and certainly for thousands of years people believe that. The reason is, and there's no time for me to really get into this on this, is that if you look at studies, some really amazing studies that would have shown validity if it had any, show that it doesn't have validity.
Okay.
That's why.
All right, Howard, thank you very much. Over to Aida in Albany, you're on.
Hi. I was just wondering, in terms of the Arecibo observatory,
yeah.
I really think, wouldn't it be worth it to fix it? I remember about 7 years ago, my husband and I were there, and there's so many stories that people will tell you about.
No, they say it's irreparable. The damage is irreparable.
Ah.
Yeah.
Is it really?
Yeah. When it first started to collapse a couple months ago, they seriously considered fixing it, but they couldn't get the money together in time and, you know, all that bureaucratic stuff. And then it started to just continue to fall apart. And now that the top part has fallen down into the dish, it's pretty much completely destroyed.
Done. Okay. Well, I'm going to go see it. But anyway, the point is that my husband and I saw about 6 orange lights, and maybe you can explain this. And they were flying down, and then all of a sudden, one dropped, and they dropped in a 90-degree angle and went off to the right and disappeared. Then the next one, and then the next one, and then the next one. And by the way, all the lights had gone out in the town.
Where was this?
This was in the west coast of Puerto Rico.
Oh, my gosh. So while you were there to see the Arecibo, this happened?
Well, no. We were there because we have a home there. But we were in the balcony, and we just go there for the winter. And we were there, and all of a sudden, we had a blackout. And then we all ran to the porch. We had another friend with us. And we all three of us saw the same thing. They were orange.
Could it have been fireworks?
Orange, a little bit smaller than a moon. And they were in line, and then they dropped, but one by one, like in formation. One, went to the right and disappeared. The next one, and they all disappeared. And we didn't know what they
went. Why couldn't it have been either fireworks or an air show?
Yeah, could have been that. Maybe a drone or something too.
Say it again.
I have no idea.
It sounds to me like you're describing military flares, though. I mean, could it have been?
Well, that's what I thought. I said, could it be a military kind of thing? But not. And people always around that area, people will tell you stories. That's why a lot of so many stories have come up that Asimov would love. I mean, it's one of those things that about the things appear and disappear and. Yeah. I'm fascinated by it.
There have been many a fine UFO story out of Puerto Rico. I know that for sure. Valerie.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. We did send the message to the aliens from Arecibo. So, maybe they're trying to come back and visit us. Who knows?
I think it's interesting, that all the lights went out in the town. So someday, I keep saying, we're going to do a UFO show again. And I hope you call back. Thank you for that. 800-348-2551. Tom and Gardner. Tom, you're on.
Yeah, I have a. First, I want to help the lady who wants to find meteorites. I heard on this radio station how to catch micrometeorites. You take a cat litter box and put a few inches of water in it and just lay it out someplace where there's no tree cover or anything and leave it for a few hours, and they'll be in there. And, you take a strong magnet and put it in a cellophane bag and run that through the water, and the micrometeorites that have iron in them will be attracted to it. And then you take that out, and then you take the magnet out of the bag and just rinse off the bag into a small dish. But they're microscopic is the thing.
Oh, yeah. Hey, that was on the Science Forum. Yeah. Yeah, I remember that now. Hey, good for you, Tom.
Yeah, there you go.
I hosted that show. That's right. Good for you, man.
Here's my question.
All right.
Thank you. My question is, space is expanding. According to our model, what about the space that exists inside atoms, inside the electron cloud of an atom, inside our bodies, or the space in the atmosphere? There's in between the atoms, it's just empty space.
No, you have to realize that the expansion of the universe is only a large scale phenomenon. It doesn't occur even in as large a space as a cluster of galaxies, and that's pretty big.
For example,
we live in a cluster of 30 galaxies. There's no expansion in our local group of galaxies. It's only groups of galaxies moving away from other groups of galaxies. But within each group, let alone each galaxy, let alone each star, let alone each atom, or our bodies, or our planet, there's no trace of any expansion.
Okay, that's good. And Tom, thank you for the call. Valerie, we've been through this before, but explain to me why it works on a large scale and not a small scale, and then we'll go to the next call.
Yeah, it all has to do with the forces that act. So when you're on this large scale, as Bob was saying, the galaxies are expanding, the universe is expanding. That is a force that acts on a big scale. But when you get to the atomic scale, you get down to things like the strong force that are holding the nuclei and holding the atoms together. And that only works on these tiny microscopic atomic scales. So it's a scale difference.
Okay.
One's really large, one's really small, and different forces are acting.
Let's go to Marianne in New Paltz. Marianne, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering if the experts can shed any light on something that I saw this morning in the sky, I'd say to the east, maybe the northeast, and it was 6 a.m. It looked a lot like...
It was Venus.
Star. It was Venus.
Yes.
Okay. Yep.
Wow.
Okay.
That's an easy one.
Say it again, Marianne.
The only planet you can... How come it's the only planet you would see at that time, at 6 a.m.?
Well, it's a morning star currently, Venus, and it's brighter than any true star in the sky, as I'm sure you noticed. And this is its time to be a morning star. Catch it a year from now, and it won't be there. So, it just this happens to be its time to be a morning star, and it's right where you described.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marianne. And now to Chris in Housatonic. Chris, you're on with Valerie Rapson at Bob Berman.
Yeah, Valerie and Bob. I have I called in yesterday. I'm calling in today. But I was over at Great Barrington Airport the other night. And I saw, and it was very overcast. And it was coming from the north to northwest, over the mountaintops. And the sky was like a bright red, and I said to myself, I don't know what that is. It couldn't have been the moon. It couldn't have been Mars because it was overcast. And it was really, really kind of spooky, if you know what I mean, because I've never seen that in the sky. And then the second question is, I don't know if you both know that Boeing is going ahead with a very powerful rocket to go to the moon and Mars.
Oh, the competition is quite fierce on the rocket front. Now, let's go to, we only have a couple of minutes here. Let's try to delve into the redness in the sky. Valerie, you get the first question of Chris and Housatonic.
Yeah, so with it being overcast, it definitely had to be something terrestrial, right? You're not going to see the planets and the moons through the clouds, as you said. So, again, it sounds kind of like, you know, airplane, military craft, maybe drones. It just depends on, you know, exactly where the light was reflecting. And with the clouds there, you can things can look a little bit brighter than they might actually be because you've got reflection off of the layers of the clouds, too. So I don't really know exactly what you saw, but it probably wasn't something in space.
Bob.
Well, we're back to the make up something section of the show. So, what Valerie said is true with an overcast sky. But I didn't understand whether the caller was talking about a redness that was diffuse that covered much of the sky, whether it was a star-like object, whether it was a disc like the moon. What size thing
was it? It was a redness in the sky. And things like that. And I don't know if it could have been any plane because, like I said, it was overcast.
Okay, well, I guess what Bob wants to know, Chris, is did it cover the whole horizon or was it just a dot in the sky?
Yes, it covered the whole horizon.
Aha. Okay.
Well, then you had a reflection from the ground. So, you know, there could have been any number of lights, either neon lights or spotlights or the opening of an event that has special lights on it that were just reflecting off the clouds. And so that's what was happening.
All right, Chris, thanks a lot. Very quickly, we only have now about 25 seconds. Kieran in Woodbury, you have a very short time. Go ahead.
I'll be quick. I studied divinity and Native American history at Harvard, and I just wanted to briefly note that in addition to the idea of navigating by stars does exist in Native American cultures. For example, the Lakota view the entire Black Hills as a ceremonial map of the stars, and they base their travel on that. It's not necessarily following the objects, but there could be potential ways that perhaps the Magi had some connections with that, although I definitely big fan of religion and silence, and I acknowledge some of the complexity of astrology and Christian history, too.
I really like that answer, and we are done. That's a beautiful way to wrap up this program. Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson, thank you both for being here.
Thank you. This is great.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
We'll talk to you all soon. Support comes from Adele Shafridi Studio and Gallery, a new jewelry store in Rhinebeck featuring studio-made fine jewelry using recycled 18-karat gold, platinum, and silver, natural colored gemstones at conflict-free diamonds, shafridi.com. At the Daily Grind, Albany, New York, a proud underwriter of WAMC, roasting and serving coffee for over 40 years, serving breakfast all day, open 7 days, dailygrind.com. Once again, thanks to Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the great calls. We will get to more of them next time. Our astronomers will be back soon. Tomorrow, oh, this is great. Tomorrow on Food Friday, Anissa Waheed will be here from Tara Kitchen, and that's always fun. So join us for that at 2 p.m. Now, at the end of this program, which is coming up shortly, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo will deliver an update on the COVID-19 pandemic from Albany, and we will air that live as it begins. We'll talk to you tomorrow.